At best, food poisoning can make you feel miserable. At its worst, it can kill you. Salmonella has been back in the news recently, identified as the source of food poisoning in nearly 300 people across 18 different states. So to talk about what salmonella is, where it comes from, and why it makes us sick, as well as some other pathogens that might cause foodborne illnesses, we have invited to today's Please Explain Dr. Urvashi Rangan, a toxicologist and the executive director of the Consumer Reports Food Safety and Sustainability Center, and Dr. Stephen Morris, professor of epidemiology at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. And I thank both of you for being on our show. We also invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's begin with you, Dr. Morris. Is the term food poisoning accurate? Are we really being poisoned?
Well, we often use that term, but really in most cases, this is a product that's made by bacteria that have been growing in the food and that leave behind a toxic material that makes us sick. I distinguish that from foodborne infections, although the results are very much the same. We all know what it feels like. The foodborne infections are actually living bacteria or viruses that get into our gastrointestinal tracts and obviously wreak havoc for a few days, but they also can be transmitted to other people.
So, Dr. Rangan, what is salmonella? Because it's been specifically in the news. Is it foodborne or is it...
It is foodborne. Salmonella is a bacteria that lives in the gut of animals primarily, and poultry in particular. And it's something that during slaughter with poor slaughter practices and things like that, where you're moving things that are in the gut lines that can contaminate the meat, that's usually the way that we can spread contamination from the gut to the actual meat products. And salmonella itself, there's many different types of salmonella. The one we're hearing about today in this outbreak is called Salmonella Heidelberg. And then every even serotype of salmonella has its own fingerprint. And in the case of this particular outbreak, there are 7 different fingerprint strains of Salmonella Heidelberg that are associated with the current outbreak that's going on.
Dr. Morris, if I looked at it under a microscope, might I be able to distinguish Heidelberg? I'm assuming it got the name because the first time it was identified in Heidelberg, Germany, not because it started in Heidelberg. But
no, they belong to all of us. So many of these are all over the world, and they have such interesting names.
But would I be able to distinguish it from other kinds of salmonella?
No, basically they all look pretty much alike under the microscope. Was mentioned, the serological test, that is using antibodies that you can artificially inoculate animals and they make antibodies to it, or people who've had the infection may make antibodies. You can use those to distinguish many of these strains, and also genetic tests, looking at their DNA. They have distinctive features, but otherwise they look exactly the same, and many of them do exactly the same things when we swallow them.
Urvashi, what does gram-negative or gram-positive mean in identifying pathogens?
Well, pathogens are generally, and bacteria really, are classified into those camps as gram-negative or gram-positive. It has to do with the gram stain test and whether they stain positive or not in that test. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the virulence of that particular organism.
And what's the difference between infectious and contagious in this discussion? Is there a difference?
Yes, actually. Most of us use the term infection and use those two terms almost interchangeably. But in fact, something that's infectious can infect you, can cause illness in the body. Something that's contagious, which is sort of an older term, means something that can actually be transmitted from person to person, like many of these foodborne illnesses, which do both. They infect you, and then they can also spread from person to person in many cases.
Well, the most important thing when we see an outbreak is to find out its source, right? Urvashi, you and your colleagues helped identify the source of the most recent outbreak of salmonella. How did you do that?
Well, I'm not sure we are the source of the source, but we did have one sample in our ongoing research of safety in the meat and poultry supply, and we had a sample from Foster Farms that we had purchased out in California. And just earlier this week, in fact, we received a message from the public health lab that did the confirmation test that it was a match to the outbreak strain. We had already been looking at the profile of this particular outbreak in general and wondering why it hadn't been ratcheted up to a recall level given how many illnesses had occurred and the severity of the illnesses out there. This Salmonella Heidelberg outbreak seems to have led to double the hospitalization rate. Just over 40% of the folks who have been sickened have been in the hospital. That's twice the expected rate, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So it's not typical for us to go out with the results of just one finding like that. And certainly salmonella is allowed at a certain level in chicken. There is a background level and a performance standard that USDA has set around 7.5% incidence. So 7.5% of the chicken out there and in their sampling plans is allowed to have salmonella. What made this unusual for us at Consumer Reports was the fact that we had a strain that matched a current ongoing outbreak. And in that sense, we really had a public service duty to report that immediately to the public, to the government officials, provide all of the information about the resistance that that particular strain carried as well, and report that right away to the government. We also, our position is that consumers shouldn't be taking any chances here with what is coming out of these plants, given that no action has been taken at this time. We're advising consumers to avoid any product from those three specific plants.
Now, Stephen, what about the virulence? 7.5% doesn't seem to cause a problem. Is it just the amount of salmonella that's in the thing that we're eating, or is it do they vary in power and toxicity?
No, they do, and this one is particularly virulent. But also, as Irvashi mentioned, a 40% hospitalization rate. But also,
which
it depends.
Very high.
That's high. It also depends on the individual. You know, some people, young people, for example, the elderly. I put myself in that category now. I'm getting there. And, you know, those who may have other illnesses, immunosuppressive disorders or taking immunosuppressive therapies, may be more susceptible to serious disease. So it really is the strain, but also how your body responds to it.
Now, who's most responsible, Irvashi, for finding out about these things, doing the testing? Is it the Center for Disease Control, or is it the Food and Drug Administration?
It's actually...
Or the Agriculture Department?
Yeah, it's all of them. And so the way it works is that our Center for Disease Control and Prevention are really monitoring people and illnesses, and people who end up in the hospital will often have a fecal stool culture, and if that culture can come out positive, it is difficult to culture from fecal matter, but once they have a positive, that goes into a database with a DNA fingerprinting for what is actually coming out of ill people who are in the hospital. So that's what CDC is sort of monitoring and looking at. At the same time, the USDA is taking samples from the plants, and they are looking for the same, whether that bacteria, the same strain, the same type, the same fingerprint is coming out of the chicken at the plants. And those correlations have actually been made. The FDA in this will go to the retail outlets and sample from retail outlets. And we also have another government program that is a partnership among all three of those agencies called NARMS. And it's the National Antimicrobial Resistance Surveillance Program. And they're also looking at the antibiotic resistance patterns that occur on all these things. If a plant is to be shut down or a voluntary recall requested, which is pretty much all the USDA can do, which is unfortunate, it's the USDA that would request the company to issue a recall. USDA can deem that product adulterated if they want to, but as of this morning, the USDA has said they will not, and they have deemed what Foster Farms plans to do to address the problem to be sufficient to keep the plants open at this time. The CDC, like I say, is monitoring the illnesses going on. And what's really, I think, particularly hard for us to understand is at what level of evidence do you actually need to say, no, this product is causing a problem? Because what we have right now in this case are 300 illnesses. CDC has a lot of information on the bacteria that's come out of a lot of those illnesses. They match the types of bacteria that are being found in the Foster Farms chicken that is being produced. And yet, because we don't have somebody who got ill, who somehow retained their packaging with the plant number on it that could be tested to directly link it, that connection is still not being made at a government level from USDA, and therefore a recall has not even been requested. And we think that's problematic. We think that the information they have today is enough to say that there is a problem. And we're just on the heels of a recent outbreak of the same organism that's associated with this outbreak from the same company that just occurred last year. And that follows on the heels of a decade, really, of the Oregon Department of Health questioning why 10 illnesses a year have been associated with Foster Farms chickens. So there's a history here in the backdrop of all of this that we feel also needs to be taken into account. This outbreak is not going on in a vacuum, and there's really a lot of parameters right now that need to be looked at. It's also worth mentioning that in just as recently as September, the incidence rate of salmonella coming out of these particular plants is hovering around 25%. The performance standard that's set is 7.5%. So even that should be reason alone for USDA to be applying intense scrutiny on these plants, if not shutting them down, especially in the wake of these illnesses.
Well, I'll be sure never to buy anything that says Foster Farms when I'm looking for chicken. But, Steve, has the situation been exacerbated by this government shutdown, or are the inspectors who don't seem to be able to catch these sporadic outbreaks of food contamination in the first place, are they still on the job, so to speak?
Well, the shutdown certainly hasn't helped, and it's reduced capabilities considerably. On the other hand, there is the possibility CDC, for example, can call in people for emergencies like this. So the government has responded, and although probably it could have responded more strongly without the shutdown, you know, I think the miracle is that it's able to do it. One issue is that with food safety, we're doing a lot better thanks in part to some food safety legislation passed a couple of years ago. But at the same time, as Irvashi mentions, there is really everybody is in charge and nobody is in charge. So there is coordination among these three agencies on certain programs. But at the same time, it's really hard to decide who's going to take the lead and how these decisions get made because there are so many agencies involved in this process.
Shouldn't the salmonella bacteria have been killed by the cooking process, or are the people who are coming down with the people who are just handling it before they put it in the oven?
Well, that gets to a very important point, which is ultimately, you know, we certainly want the production to be as clean as possible. We want the entire chain getting to the consumer to be as clean as possible. But salmonella is also ubiquitous. So while there's no excuse for high levels of contamination in a plant, that shows a breakdown in the proper procedures. At the same time, we can do something to protect ourselves by handling this food properly. And I think we really need to, because there's no way to be sure that there won't be some contamination.
I just heard recently that the old instructions to wash the chicken before you cook it may not be the best thing, because the water spraying on it actually is spreading any bacteria that's on the chicken.
Well, you know, I'm waiting for additional evidence on that. But in any case, I think you should wash the utensils that you've used
and wash your hands
on any raw meat or chicken. Wash your hands, certainly, before you handle anything. And don't put the raw and the cooked together. This sounds like an anthropological exercise, but it's really an important thing. And there are many other foodborne diseases that, you know, we can also encounter, and many of the same precautions will also work. We can't control everything, but at least we can prevent something like this.
And we'll come back to some of those other four foodborne diseases and listener calls and comments. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guests are Dr. Stephen Morse, professor of epidemiology at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health, and Dr. Urvashi Rangan, who's a toxicologist and the executive director of the Consumer Reports Food Safety and Sustainability Center. Be back right after this. Have you ever wondered what your waiter thinks of you? Well, next Tuesday at 7 at the Green Space, we'll talk to 5 waiters, including a father-son team from Restaurant Daniel, who'll give us the inside scoop on dining do's and don'ts and how to get treated like a regular even when you're not, and whether what they think of that tip that you gave them. We'll even show you how to uncork a bottle of wine and debone a fish like a pro. There are just a few tickets left for Tuesday night, but you can still join us for the other two parts of the Lopate and Locavore series. Although you can also probably get a ticket for Tuesday. For tickets, go to WNYC.org/thegreenspace. I'll be there, and I hope you can join us. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with today's Please Explain look at food poisoning with Dr. Urvashi Rangan, who's a toxicologist, executive director of the Consumer Reports Food Safety and Sustainability Center, and Dr. Stephen Morse, professor of epidemiology at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And listeners have been calling in and writing in. Cheryl asks, my son had bad salmonella infection a few years ago, and since he now has antibodies, is he now immune to future infection? Steve?
Unfortunately not, and I'm glad your son has recovered. For one thing, there are so many different salmonella strains that if you get one, you could easily be reinfected with a different one, and you'd hardly know the difference except by lab testing. Some salmonella strains also can reinfect, and for example, typhoid, which is not normally a foodborne disease, but the most serious of all the known salmonellas, can actually reinfect people who've been naturally infected.
Thank you so much for writing in. We have a bunch of people writing in. Elaine from Baltimore writes, I roast garlic cloves in olive oil and serve it as a spreading for bread. I heard that it must be kept in the fridge or it can grow bacteria. Since garlic and oil do not have to be refrigerated if kept separately, why does a cooked mixture need to be?
That's a good question. I think if you ask any of us for advice, we'll always advise you to refrigerate things. That's just a safety issue. I've never tried leaving it outside, so I can't tell you. It might be perfectly safe, but we usually like to be on the safe side and refrigerate things.
Ilana from Inwood, Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I just have a question about washing produce, and one of the things I wonder about a lot is whether it's necessary to wash the greens that you get that say that they're already rinsed. And more generally, you know, is it necessary to wash produce in the produce wash product, that kind of thing.
Now, Urvashi, produce is not does it also carry salmonella?
So produce can carry some salmonella just from fertilizers that are used. We use lots of manure-based fertilizers. So all these pathogens are sort of game for really any food that we're eating. Remember the peanut butter recall that we had? That was all salmonella. There's also listeria and other things. The particular concern around greens is that they're ready to eat, so you would want to eat them and not cook them, presumably, if you're doing a salad bag or something like that. We actually recommend you should just wash those greens and soak them in water, if anything, to remove additional slime and buildup that's occurred. You may or may not get rid of all the bacteria, depending on where it is in those greens, but we think it's a good rule of thumb to go ahead and wash them anyway.
Should we know where they're from before we buy them? Would that help at all?
No.
No, I would agree. I think the most important thing is to handle them properly. And I would agree with washing vegetables. We used to think it was the meat, but the infamous E. coli strains that can cause so much problems have also been found on vegetables, as well as in chopped meat, for example. And we've even seen cases of hepatitis A with cantaloupe, which suggests that probably we should be washing the outsides of all of our fruits and vegetables. Although it sounds odd, I think that's really the right precaution.
Although I'm never sure what washing means in that circumstance. Do you just stick it under the water for a little bit, or are we talking about serious using some dish soap on a cantaloupe?
I think putting it under the water is usually enough, but I think that's a matter of personal choice. Some people use dish soap, some people use plain water, some people use even bleach solution. That may be going further than necessary in most cases. But getting just to mention that earlier question, there have been some outbreaks that have occurred with even so-called triple-washed, ready-to-eat salad greens. So it is a good idea to make sure that they're washed, I think, in the traditional way that we've done it, but obviously not just a little water.
And we would agree, too, you don't need to take a sledgehammer to these things, but we do think a good rinse with water and getting a good vegetable brush is actually one of the best tips of all, and actually it relates to even any pesticide residue or other things, but getting a vegetable brush and really sort of going at those things with a brush is a very good way to wash your fruits and vegetables.
Hannah from Manhattan says she washes her chicken with white vinegar before she cooks it and wants to know if that will help kill salmonella.
Vinegar is not a disinfectant, and at the concentration levels of acetic acid that are in the vinegar, and I think that's a very common misnomer in the public that vinegar is somehow a disinfectant. So it's not going to address the bacteria. It can be a grease cutter, and it can maybe cut through some of the waxy residue on things, but vinegar itself is not a disinfectant. If you're trying to go for a disinfectant, even if you're cleaning counters and cutting boards, or even your refrigerator every so often, a 10% bleach solution is a disinfecting kind of solution. Hydrogen peroxide is a disinfectant. Alcohol is, and very high water temperatures, like what's in your dishwasher, can act as a sterilizing sort of mechanism. Those are the ways. Dish soap is also a very good way to clean your counters and to really lather it up and clean it. Just like when we have the flu going around, the advice to people is wash your hands a lot, and plain soap and water is good enough to do that. So you should be able to, even with plain soap and water, take care of a lot of the cleaning business around bacteria that needs to be done.
Keith from, is it Princeton, New Jersey? Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm from Princeton Health Department, actually. Love the show, Leonard.
Thank you.
I believe I could comment on an earlier question that was made regarding olive oil and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as New Jersey state law goes, garlic can contain botulism spores that come from the ground. So if the oil is an anaerobic environment and the garlic is on the bottom of that oil, botulism can then create a toxin. So the garlic and oil solution should be used within a day or two of being made, or refrigerated, or discarded.
Okay, thank you so much.
You.
Sometimes it's the combination that causes the problem. We now go to Carrie from Rhinecliff. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I attended a conference a couple of years ago that was hosted by the Swedish government, and I was astonished to learn that they have essentially eradicated salmonella from virtually all of their red and white meat. So if they can do it, why can't we?
That's a great question, and that's absolutely true, and I think it's really the kind of hope on the horizon here, which is that it is actually possible to tackle salmonella in the food system, and Sweden's done it, and their approach is far more comprehensive than our approach. So while we spend a lot of time at the plants and looking what's happening at the plants, we don't tend to focus on the root causes of the problem, which, as I mentioned earlier, is really about can be about anyway, even down to the breeding stock of chickens. In fact, salmonella can be starting at that point in the eggs at the hatchery. And unless you take a look at the entire continuum all the way down, you actually don't know where the problem is starting. And so Sweden actually has a program in place that forces them, if they find contamination at the plant, to start backing up all the way to the hatchery. And if they document problems all the way there, they will actually take the entire system down and they will begin again. And that is why Sweden has been able to achieve that, because their actions are far more comprehensive and in-depth than ours are.
And I assume there are a number of other countries that are better at this than we are, too.
Yes.
Steve, I just want to talk a bit about what might happen if we eat something that's contaminated. How long an incubation period should we assume there is?
Well, it depends on what we've eaten. For most of the bacteria, it's a couple of days. And
then what happens? What are the symptoms that something's wrong? They don't show up right away?
Probably the ones we've all experienced. Diarrhea is the commonest. And with salmonella, probably the most likely symptom. Sometimes those who are sicker may experience some fever or feeling like flu. And in most cases, most people will probably just shrug it off and get on with life. But they should be careful about the possibility that it can be transmitted to others. And, of course, if they feel really sick, they should call their healthcare provider.
They often call it a stomach flu.
Yes. And
is this happening in our stomach or is it happening in our intestines?
That's in the intestines with the bacteria, but there are viruses, the so-called noroviruses, which are very numerous and very common, and they've been associated, of course, very famously with cruise ships, but they occur all over, and they usually cause rather severe vomiting that goes on for about a day, and then you feel fine, but it's really very unpleasant while you have it.
Now, Irvashi, I read once on the CDC website that there are some 70 to 80 million cases of food poisoning in the United States each year. Is that possible?
It's really incredible. I mean, those are the estimates, and they have actual numbers as well. But CDC does reporting out every year, and that's part of the NARMS program, talking about the estimated number of illnesses. And it is tremendous. And the safety of our meat supply, we think, needs to be carefully scrutinized here. And we spent a lot of time talking about pathogens and the presence of those things, but the levels of antibiotic resistance that they carry and the fact that they can spread that among themselves, among other bacteria, is also leading to a significant public health crisis around how we then can treat these infections, especially for those where it gets very severe.
Steve, we've been talking, we have very little time, but we've been talking about bacteria. Are there also viruses that cause these illnesses?
Oh, sure. And we just touched on the noroviruses, which used to be called the Norwalk-like agents. And there are a host of them. Unfortunately, having one doesn't necessarily protect you against another. But those cause what people often do call the stomach flu, far more often than the flu does. And it's very, very unpleasant, really, for about a day or two.
So should I assume that many of us have had one of these things, just felt queasy, uncomfortable, had diarrhea, but had no idea that we were really suffering from some kind of food poisoning?
Yes, I think that's very true. I think it's estimated that about 30% of the population at any one time has diarrhea, and most of the time we don't even know what's causing it. Of course, as an epidemiologist, I'd like to know better, but unfortunately, most of the time, you know, it's just something we live with, and fortunately, we do get over it.
But I think it is important also to mention that the very young and children and the very old and the elderly are at particular risk for foodborne illness. They can't handle it quite as well when they get it, and they are a vulnerable population.
And Irvashi, we have to leave it there. But we've all been warned. Dr. Irvashi Rangan, yeah. Toxicologist and Executive Director of the Consumer Reports Food Safety and Sustainability Center. Dr. Stephen Morse, Professor of Epidemiology at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to join you.
On Monday's show, Florida Congresswoman and Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz talks about the challenges facing America and Congress. And then actor James Franco talks about his acting and directing career, his debut novel, Actors Anonymous, and his latest film based on Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. Amy Grace Lloyd discusses her new novel, The Affairs of Others, about a young woman who's drawn into the lives of her neighbors, and find out why Howard Gardner says our reliance on smart gadgets is robbing us of a sense of identity, crippling our relationships, and even stunting our imaginations. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Jim Corcoran, Jessica Miller, and Fanny Cohen. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Victoria Washington was at the audio controls. We had help today from Matthew McDonough and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.